Fake news and bad analysis today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Social media often feeds us stories we want to be true but are not. And one expert has a message for the likes of Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg.
If you've got so rich off our human nature and desire to connect, that wealth and that power comes with a responsibility to say, well, maybe we shouldn't serve Halloween candy for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Plus, one migrant's journey from the Middle East to the north of England.
This is in my home. It's changed from the chicken house to a small flat. I have 2 rooms. And one kitchen.
And your survival strategies for mixing family and politics this Thanksgiving. That's all ahead today on The World. Thank you for being with us on this Monday. In our efforts to share things we like with our friends on platforms like Facebook and Google, we often overlook a basic fact. These social media giants curate what we see in the order they choose. Or rather, their computer algorithms curate what we see and in what order. Sometimes that means serving up fake news for you and you and you and me. Other times it might mean offering us comfort food, posts that just confirm our own biases. And lately that's led to a lot of criticism for Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. But now Zuckerberg says he's hoping to rein in the spread of misinformation. He's vowed to fine-tune those algorithms. Zeynep Tufekci at the University of North Carolina says fine-tuning Facebook to remove fake news from across the political spectrum should have been done years ago.
You know, liberal or conservative, I don't see anything that should cause any controversy. And the fact that it took so much pressure and effort, that's a little disconcerting that we're here after so much has already happened in the sphere. But it's an interesting moment in that most of the ad money that used to go to newspapers that supported journalism. It wasn't perfect journalism, but it was still journalism that was supported by the ad money. Right now, this ad money is going more and more to Facebook and to a degree to Google. They're gobbling up literally almost 2/3 of the ad money out there.
Well, I was reading this weekend about advertising products on Facebook called dark posts, newsfeed messages targeting specific people, political ads, for example, as one person said in the New York Times, ads that push the exact right buttons for the exact right people at the exact right times. How does this all work?
In this campaign, Donald Trump's social media team has given an interview to Bloomberg where they said they specifically targeted African Americans and young women with messages that they hoped would be demobilizing. So those were ads that only they would see. And they would highlight comments that Clinton might have made about the super predator comment from some years ago that got some play. So they would sort of package that comment and aim it at African-American men, or they would highlight something about Bill Clinton and try to flood young women's social media network with this. It's not meant to persuade anyone because those aren't very likely Donald Trump constituencies. It's meant to discourage people from voting in a way that you don't get a chance to counter it. So you don't know until the election is over and the Donald Trump social media team says, look, we did this, which they said they did this, so I'm not making this up from my own observations. I wrote about this in 2012 after President Obama won. And I said, look, these tools that a lot of people credit President Obama with winning, I said these tools, wherever you are on the political spectrum, have great potential for misinformation, for these dark ads that are targeted to specific people that unlike TV ads or radio ads or newspaper ads or editorials that you never get a chance to see. So there's no rebuttal going on. And they are fed by these algorithms that promote virality. So if it's outrageous, it goes viral. If it is getting a lot of people hating it, it also goes viral because there's a lot of comments on it, though. And I try to warn about the dangers of this for our democracy. If anybody cares about having a democracy in which we can actually debate ideas, we can actually debate policy, and that we're not completely polarized into these dueling factions who live in alternate universes to each other, we have to care about how do we create some common ground rather than be drowning in these clickbait which is often produced for profit. It's not even produced by partisans. We saw some of the biggest pieces of fake news, like Hillary Clinton killed an FBI agent kind of fake news, was produced by a bunch of teenagers in Macedonia.
Right.
All they wanted to do was make a few bucks, and that's kind of crazy.
It's still flabbergasting just hearing you say this. I mean, we heard a lot of this during the campaign. I know you wrote about it a few years ago, and now we're discussing it again. I mean, it's like wag the dog on steroids. So why can't Facebook train its software to spot bogus stories?
Well, it can do that, and it should do that, and it just didn't do that. It's more profitable, I suppose, and also makes them able to claim we didn't do anything. I can't really explain why. It seems irresponsible to me not to do this. So the other thing is, though, it's not just tweeting at bogus news, which would be great. That would be a very important first step. But I hope they would also try to figure out a way not to create more polarized information bubbles around us. I want to be clear. This is coming from the demand side as well. We're kind of clicking on
I was going to say, I mean, I know how most of my friends use Facebook. They're not looking for people who disagree with them. And I get that. We're looking for like-minded people for our own community. So how much do you think Facebook is responsible for our self-affirmations of our own beliefs? And how much are we responsible?
It's not an either or. It's true, for example, that people have a sweet tooth. That still wouldn't make it okay for a school cafeteria to serve Halloween candy to students for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So I would be first to say that the filter bubbles and this clicking on things we like and being close to countering information, it comes from human nature. What Facebook has done, however, is build a business that amplifies and entrenches this. There are places around in the world where Facebook and the internet are basically interchangeable. That's all people have. If you got to be a $300-400 billion company in space of a decade because you put yourself as an intermediary between us and our loved ones, us and our acquaintances, and us and our news, if you've got so rich off our human nature and desire to connect, that wealth and that power comes with a responsibility to say, well, maybe we shouldn't serve Halloween candy for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Yes, people want this stuff and they will click on this stuff, but maybe we shouldn't let a bunch of Macedonian teenagers flood U.S. electorate with absolutely fraudulent stuff and make money while they're doing this.
And so yet there's Mark a lot they could do. And yet Mark Zuckerberg talks about erring on the side of letting people share what they want whenever possible, i.e. eating the Halloween candy for breakfast, and not being an arbiter of truth. So are you hopeful that the business model will change at Facebook?
It will change if the people who work at Facebook's much more than Mr. Zuckerberg. If the people who work at Facebook consider where they want their name to be when history books about this period are written. So can something be done? Yes. Is Facebook the only culpable actor in all the things we do? Of course not. It's a complicated mix, and there's a lot more we can talk about. But Facebook has a major role that comes from its power, its unique positioning in that it has no competitor and has 2 billion people, that it controls what they see every day. And this is really more than the stock options the people who work there are going to get. This is about what it's going to say in the history books. I think a lot can be done.
Zeynep Tufekci at UNC often joins us on The World to talk about society and technology. Thanks very much, Zeynep.
Thank you.
It's not that hard to ascertain whether a story is fake or not. What's harder is to assess the comparisons that columnists and comedians have been making between Donald Trump, who is not yet president, and other leaders who are in the history books. One comparison has been getting a lot of traction, and it's one that was first brought to mass media nearly a year ago by Daily Show host Trevor Noah.
Now, I understand that Trump is a little scary. A little exotic for some. A little out of America's comfort zone, but this great country is capable of bold leaps. It took one in 2008 when it elected its first black president. Now in 2016, I say it's time to be bold once more and elect America's first African president.
An intriguing joke at the time, but since then there have been more than a few writers comparing the president-elect to some of Africa's longest-serving, most corrupt leaders. Indiana University historian Marissa Moorman thinks the comparisons are a little too easy.
I think it raises some interesting questions, but it's obviously a limited sort of comparison. It, you know, it lacks nuance, but it does raise some interesting questions, and it does some useful work in making us think in different ways and challenging our notions about the way democracy works in our own country.
So specifically, where do you think the comparison falls down?
It falls down in the sense that we don't live in an entirely authoritarian society. Democracy still works in many ways. The press is still functioning, and there are a number of things that any one of us can do without having our liberty of expression curtailed. At the same time, I think the comparison opens up some interesting challenges to what we think of as the very liberal and open democracy that we live in.
What do you think the questions are that are raised by the comparison?
The questions have to do, I think, very particularly with the kind of campaign that Trump ran, the kinds of people that he's appointing to his cabinet and to his staff, and the kind of person that he is and the kind of politician and president he will be.
One thing that you haven't mentioned where there do seem to be some parallels is nepotism. I mean, there's a lot of nepotism in the presidential palaces across the African continent, and we are seeing a lot of Trump's family in the transition process, and there's a sense that they'll be involved in some aspects of goings-on at the White House. Some parallels there, perhaps, with African dictators?
For sure. I'd be very happy to speak to this. In fact, I've been thinking about it quite a bit. The place which I know best, which is Angola, suffers from many of these same problems of nepotism and conflict of interest in business. The president, José Eduardo dos Santos, has numerous business interests. His daughter, as well, holds numerous business interests in Angolan banks, and she's just been named to be the director or head of the national oil company, Sonangol, as of June 2016. And this is obviously raising a lot of alarms for Angolans, as well as for people outside the country. U.S. diplomats have, of course, advised Angolans and the Angolan government not to have politically exposed persons, people like the president, his daughter, the generals that are closest to him, involved in the banking sector, for example. So I think there's a real contradiction there between what, for example, the U.S. State Department is advising their government and what our new president-elect is doing, violating the very kinds of laws we ask other governments to uphold.
Yeah. You wonder why the State Department isn't giving the same advice to the White House. So spell this out for us. What's the danger here?
Well, the danger is, of course, that, you know, nepotism. I think it's obvious that there's just too much closeness and that they have interests. And then all of those children are also involved in his businesses, as is Jared Kushner. And the concern there is, of course, that Trump is by far the wealthiest president we have had in the history of this country. He also has numerous business interests overseas. So, of course, people who come to meet with him, as the Japanese prime minister did just a few days ago, it's never going to be entirely clear whether what they're discussing is separate from them things like business interests. If those people are later on perhaps trying to also curry business favor or making political negotiations or decisions based then on business interests as well.
Marissa Moorman, historian at Indiana University. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Let me take a couple of seconds to tell you about a story you'll hear tomorrow on The World about blue-collar workers who cross party lines in a big way this election.
Yeah, I voted for Trump. I've been a registered Democrat my whole life. Always voted Democratic. Not this time.
Workers in Indiana are worried their jobs are moving to Mexico. But during the campaign, candidate Trump made them a 100% guarantee that their factory would stay open.
100%. When you guarantee something 100%, I like those odds. So we're going to hold him accountable to his campaign promises.
Indiana workers look to President Trump to make good on his pledge to save their jobs. That's on the show tomorrow. You're with The World. Three recent snapshots for you from Europe. In France yesterday, immigration policies were front and center in the right-wing presidential primary. In Serbia today, a street brawl in the capital Belgrade led to the death of one migrant and another injured. And in the Netherlands, talks between the central government and Dutch cities on the so-called bread, bath, and bed deal to give temporary food and shelter have broken down. Three snapshots that show that across Europe, countries are still grappling with how they treat migrants and refugees. 21-year-old Fares Al-Duferi left his native Kuwait at the age of 15, and he's been on the move ever since. Reporter Adeline Sia caught up with him in the city of Leeds in England.
When I first met Fares Al-Duferi, he was living at the migrant camp of Grande Sainte near Dunkirk in northern France. He'd been stuck there for 6 months and was beginning to despair about his future and living conditions, cooped up in a tiny wooden shelter.
We're living like chicken in farm. In the night we get the sleeping, and then in the morning we get to get the food, not more.
He was longing to get to the United Kingdom, where he has family. After a trek of thousands of miles through Syria, Lebanon, and Europe, all that was left to do was cross the narrow English Channel. But that was also one of the most forbidding parts of his journey. 2 months after we'd met at the camp, out of the blue, Fares messaged me a Google map pinpointing his location, downtown Birmingham, England. He had arrived at his destination. He later told me that he'd made this frightening trip on the back of a truck after dozens of attempts.
The chance came to me in 8 p.m. in the night, and the smuggler he called, he said, "You must go to trying tonight."
Once it crossed into England, Fares jumped off the truck and made his way to the town of Croydon, where he had his initial asylum interview. Later on, he was dispatched to government housing in Leeds up north, where he now lives with his mother and one of his brothers. After spending months sleeping in tents and shelters, Fares finally gets to live in a brick-and-mortar building again. He invites me in their modest flat on a residential street.
So, this is in my home. It's changed from the chicken house to a small flat. And I'm happy for that. I have 2 rooms and 1 chicken. And 1 kitchen.
With true Middle Eastern hospitality, Fares' mother brings in a tray of hot tea. As we sip the sweet tea, Fares reminds me that he's stateless, that he comes from a family of Bedouins who are not recognized as lawful citizens in Kuwait. Even though he says he was born there, he has no documents to prove it. So no papers means no driver's license, no access to higher education or health care. That's why he and his family left Kuwait to pursue a normal life. Fares had to recount all this to the immigration officer who first interviewed him in the UK.
I give him my story, what I see, what I have in England. I come from the best situation in the world, from the chicken house. And then he say, "Okay, you don't have any paper. So how can you prove your name?" I said, "I don't know. Just I come to you to help me." He said, "Okay, this is the small ID card that show you are like asylum seeker. So keep it and don't lose it."
This was a turning point in Fares' life. Until that day, he had never held any official document bearing his name or photo. So this card felt like a treasure to him.
And the first time when he gave me my hand, actually I even cried. And he said, "Why you cried?" I said, "This is the first time I get this small car and with my picture, with my name, my nationality." So
is it like being kind of born officially in a way?
I don't know how can I say the English, but was like I make it. Like a dream be the truth in my life.
But huge success.
Yeah, it's the first success in my life. Not more.
As Fares knows, that priceless photo ID, making him an official asylum seeker, is not a guaranteed ticket to permanent residency in the UK. And there are many immigration hurdles ahead. But for the time being, at least, Fares says he feels welcome here in Leeds. Though he could do without this nagging thing in the neighbourhood.
And you even have ice cream trucks coming by.
Yeah, but I don't love it.
No. Fares takes me on a quick tour of the small apartment.
All right, so it's a nice size room.
Yeah.
This is where your brother stays.
Yeah, this one for my brother.
In the back of the house, there's a tiny garden. Growing vegetables there could come in handy, considering that Fares' food allowance is only £35. That's about $42 per week. But even just having a regular kitchen is very gratifying.
I can cook, wash my clothes, eating in my table and eating what I want, cook what I want. Like the normal human, I have a place. It's better than a chicken house in the camp.
It strikes me that Fares has come a long way from his days in the Grand Saint camp, which migrants refer to as the jungle. But he's grateful that his experience there opened him up to other people and cultures. The day I visited him in Leeds, a Kurdish friend from the camp joined us. 26-year-old Sarhang Omar Shera says their friendship is highly unusual.
When I hug him in the jungle, I said to him, I really don't like Arabian people, but I really like you. all the time I said to him, because in Middle East, Arabian people, they don't like Kurdish people.
That's why Faris says their friendship is a remarkable achievement.
We changed something in our life. We've broken some rules. We broke the racism between Arabic and Kurdish peoples between different countries.
Faris says learning English not only enabled him to communicate and make friends like Sarhang, but it helped him survive. Now he hopes to be able to study the language and someday earn a living as a translator. For now, though, he's in limbo, waiting to hear about his asylum status, but relieved he's made it this far.
I am very lucky to make it in England. The hope start again. I was very lucky.
For the world, Adeline Cyr, Leeds, England.
Abel Tesfaye is a son of migrants who left Ethiopia for Canada. You've maybe heard of Abel before. He's a singer known as The Weeknd. It may not make sense when you hear this, but The Weeknd grew up listening to classic Ethiopian singers like Mulatu Astatke and Aster Aweke. In a recent interview, he said he and his parents would sit around drinking coffee, eating popcorn, and listening to music. It must have had some impact because he recently sampled Aster Aweke on this track, False Alarm. Yeah, it's kind of jarring, but who am I to argue with artistic decisions? Let's go back and hear the original track, Alenga, by Aster Aweke. The original source for a new tune by The Weeknd. This is legendary Ethiopian singer Aster Aweke. You're listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, some Muslim Americans say they'll support incoming President Donald Trump as best they can, but others fear the worst.
I don't think the issue of internment camps is out of the question. It just takes one catastrophic event to unleash the fear and hysteria.
That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Donald Trump made anti-Muslim rhetoric a linchpin of his campaign. At one point, Trump even suggested he would create a national registry for Muslims. And even now, his transition team is giving mixed messages over whether such a registry is in the works. Understandably, that's made many Muslim Americans nervous. Just what they're feeling is what reporter Saul Gonzalez with KCRW wanted to find out. So he went to the Islamic Center of Southern California in L.A., which serves as a kind of crossroads for the spiritual and social life for Muslims in the area. Here's his story.
This weekend, Imam Tariq Akil told congregants that he understood their anxieties about President-elect Donald Trump, like how he endorses a government registry of Muslim residents in America. But Akil said Trump shouldn't intimidate them.
It's still our responsibility to be active in the society, in the community. We still have the responsibility to go to the city council meetings, to have our input, and to do our share, and to make our contribution to a fair and just society.
Imam Akil also reminded the congregation about the expressions of support Muslims have received from non-Muslims in the wake of Trump's election.
I have never seen the outpouring and the unity and the support of the Jewish community, the Christian community, and others coming to the help of the Muslims. Allah says, I will send you help from directions you don't even see. We're getting blessings and support from places we didn't even anticipate.
After the service, many of the congregants, like Mustafa Baha, said they were wary of Trump, but hoping for the best.
You know, people have spoken. They have decided that he is going to be our president. So now we need to support him. We need to scream about anything that is not appropriate. If things that he may be doing is not right, then we, of course, we're going to fight him about it. Of course, we're going to get involved. And we're going to say, no, this is not right. This is what we would prefer you do.
As Muslim Americans adjust to the idea of a President Trump, civil rights leaders in their community are thinking about responses to possible anti-Muslim initiatives by a Trump administration.
And also, remember, focus on not just the cabinet-level official nominations, but those working directly under them.
In this video conference meeting between Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., the staff of the Muslim American Public Affairs Council, or MPAC, talked about cultivating political and grassroots support during a Trump administration. MPAC's executive director, Salam Al-Mariati, says he's worried about what might happen in the years ahead if the Muslim American community doesn't start preparing now.
I don't think the issue of internment camps is out of the question.
Really?
Really. It just takes one catastrophic event to unleash the fear and hysteria from the public and having the federal government do something that drastic.
Mariati says if the Trump administration does target the American Muslim community in a constitutionally questionable way, he'd expect cities like Los Angeles not to cooperate with federal authorities.
I think any kind of broad brushing of our community, anything having to do with a loyalty test against our community, any kind of deportations, denaturalization that is targeting our community, I want this city and I want all the major cities to uphold the Constitution.
For the World, Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
President-elect Trump has also talked tough on immigration. He says he wants to build a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border and step up deportations. Detention centers are a key part of the immigration system, and more scheduled deportations mean more immigrants will be put in these facilities while they wait for possible expulsion from the country. But there are growing concerns about how these detention centers are run, especially the ones that house women and children. To hear what life is like at one of these centers, I turned to Barbara Hines. She's a law professor at the University of Texas and regularly advises mothers at a family detention center in Karnes City, about 2 hours from Austin. I asked her, what's it like inside?
What it's like inside is very prison-like. Although the mothers may be able to, you know, walk around parts of the facility, they're very restricted when they come into the visitation center. We have to go through a metal detector to see the mothers. And, of course, most recently, there have been restrictions on crayons and other issues like that, which make legal access, which is so important for these women, even more difficult.
So you talked about this incident with the crayons. U.S. immigration officials banned crayons from the visitors area. What was that all about?
GEO, which is a for-profit center which makes millions of dollars on the detention of children, stated that the children had destroyed property. They had colored on the tables and perhaps colored on the walls. Instead of coming up with any reasonable alternative or thinking that this is part of what you do when you have children in a facility, that is, you clean the walls, you repaint them, ICE took the most extreme position and said no crayons and no markers for children anymore. That means that we can't distract children as we talk to their mothers who are, you know, relating to us the most horrible and tragic narratives of abuse and persecution in their home countries. It's really important that we can have the children doing something else while we are interviewing the mothers and preparing them for their cases.
Yeah, I mean, the kids, I suppose, need to be distracted. There's some pretty sensitive conversations going on, right?
Very sensitive conversations. all of the families there have witnessed or gone through tremendous trauma. So having a child having to listen to this once again that their mothers are relating. So at least while we're doing the interviews, they should be able to be coloring or doing something else while volunteers are speaking to their mothers.
Are there other ways to keep them occupied aside from crayons?
Well, the only other way that the children can be distracted is that they are confined to a small rug in the visitation area where there are toys, but the children are not allowed to move a toy off of this small rug, and they're reprimanded if they do. And for all of us that have had children, we know that to tell a two-year-old that they can't move the wheel of a truck off a small rug is a very difficult task. It's very distracting. It interrupts our ability to provide legal services. We're a very small volunteer group, and we have many, many women that we need to see.
This is a privately managed facility, though, so they can make their own rules and hold to them, right?
Yes, it's a for-profit entity that contracts with ICE, the enforcement arm of the Department of Homeland Security. They make their own rules, and they change them without any notice or discussion. We were given no notice, nor were there any discussions of any reasonable compromise. Now ICE is saying that it was a safety issue. We have never been told that this was a safety issue. It was told that the children had defaced GEO property. And, of course, there are solutions. And one thing I think that's important is that these crayons and coloring books are donated by the community. They're not even furnished by GEO.
I know there's a push among advocates like you, Barbara, to end family detention altogether. What is the alternative, though? What should the U.S. do when Border Patrol encounters women and their children at the border?
Well, community supervision. There are many organizations in the community that are willing to help women, supervise them, ensure that they go to their hearings, help them establish themselves in the community. And those alternatives are much cheaper than what it costs the taxpayer to detain this many children.
Barbara Hines provides legal support to some mothers and children at the Carnes Detention Center in Texas. Let's move on from Donald Trump and talk about another politician, German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Over the weekend, she ended months of speculation by announcing that she will run for a fourth term. To some, Merkel is a champion of Western ideals, but others have criticized her open-door refugee policy. Constanze Stelzenmüller is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's currently in Bonn, Germany. I asked her how people there are reacting to Merkel's decision.
Germany is polarized in ways that it has not been for a long time. And so there are people who are immensely relieved and who, in fact, assumed that Merkel was going to do this because really the time where she could have said no without throwing her party into disarray had already passed. Then there are those who oppose her, who no doubt will be very much heard from in coming days and weeks and months.
So Angela Merkel's father was a pastor, her mother was a teacher, all in East Germany. Merkel herself was a scientist. Tell us a little bit more about how her background may have shaped her so far.
Well, I think if you grow up in the East, and I'm a West German, but what I've learned from my Eastern friends after the fall of the wall is that you didn't do well in that kind of system if you were in any way opposed to it. If you weren't able to be very quiet and very determined and very purposeful while appearing perfectly bland. And I think that Merkel's path to power in post-reunification Germany is explained with these characteristics. This is something that she was particularly good at. She is the first woman to have run Germany, and she has really modernized the country and her own party, the Conservatives, in ways that were inconceivable beforehand.
Her stamina, her achievements, does that mean being an incumbent, if you are Angela Merkel right now, is a good thing?
No. The German Constitution does not provide for term limits to a chancellor. But just like Americans have shown that they don't like political dynasties, whether they're called Bush or Clinton, Germans don't really like, for all that they like stability, they don't really like a chancellor to stay in power that long. So she was faced with two bad choices, really. Leaving and having people say you left your job or you didn't run again at a time when your succession was uncertain and there is many problems to solve and the country needs a steady hand, and staying and running again at a time when people will then be looking for signs of her imminent demise if she is elected. Mm.
So the election in Germany is still months away. What issues, Constanze, do you think are likely to define Merkel's bid for the chancellorship?
The election date hasn't been set yet, but it's very likely that it will be in late September, at the latest early October 2017. My guess is that the biggest problem facing Merkel, next to a host of policy problems, whether it's how to deal with Syria, how to deal with Russia, how to deal with the fragmenting of the European Union, how to undertake Brexit, and how to work out a new relationship with this new American president, I think the biggest political, as opposed to policy problem for this chancellor will be, how do you find a German and European narrative that successfully counters the populist narrative that we've now seen in the American election and that we are also seeing in Europe, which is that everything is terrible, everything is going to the dogs, and the country needs an authoritarian leader to change things.
Constanze Stelzenmüller with the Brookings Institution speaking with us from Bonn. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome, Marco.
Speaking of change, President-elect Trump says he wants the U.S. out of the latest global agreement to fight climate change. Trump's victory has been the talk among delegates at this year's U.N. Climate Summit in Marrakesh, Morocco, which just wrapped its business over the weekend. There is worry, yes, but summit attendees say they think there are ways, at least parts of the U.S., can still pick up the slack. Here's reporter Susan Phillips in Marrakesh.
The U.S. climate delegation was heading into the Marrakesh Climate Summit as rock stars to many people here. After all, it was the U.S. that paired up with China to push through last year's historic Paris Agreement after decades of failure to act decisively. But instead, the delegation was left at a loss for words about what's next.
You know, I just can't speculate. I can only tell you what is right now. And you know, that'll be for the future to answer.
That's Undersecretary of State Catherine Novelli. She wanted to talk about climate change and oceans. But all the questions for her at a briefing were about what might happen to the overall climate fight under Donald Trump. The U.S. is the world's second largest current carbon emitter. It's also the biggest economy, and it was poised to play a major role in making the Paris Agreement work. But Trump has promised to pull the U.S. out of the agreement. That left everyone here scrambling to articulate a way forward. And they weren't ready to give up on a significant role for at least some parts of the U.S.
Individual U.S. states and major cities.
That's outgoing U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Like many here, he thinks cities like New York, Los Angeles, and Philadelphia, and states like California, will continue to carry the climate torch.
These are local, you know, governments. They have understood the severity of the climate change phenomenon. They are moving forward because people are demanding it, and they know that low-carbon economy, that's the answer for their business future.
California has been a leader in emissions reductions and climate change planning for years. The state sent five people to the Marrakesh talks. Some here were hoping that if the U.S. does withdraw from the Paris deal, big states like California could still help meet at least some of the emissions cuts promised by the Obama administration.
Those jurisdictions, rather than falling back in terms of their ambition, they're actually going to become more aggressive.
That's Robert Stavins of Harvard's Kennedy School. He says places like California, Washington, Oregon, and the Northeast states wouldn't be able to make up for an overall federal policy, but they could help keep the Paris process alive.
That could prevent that unraveling that is such a risk.
Formally, they will not be part of the agreement.
Teresa Ribera was Spain's negotiator at previous climate talks. She says the beauty of the Paris Agreement is its potential to recognize contributions of governments below the national level.
They will find places to be part of the solutions that are going to be built.
Ribera says it's not the ideal solution, but if Trump pulls the U.S. out of the Paris deal, it might at least provide some glue to help hold the process together. For The World, Susan Phillips, Marrakesh.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. In just a couple of minutes, how to talk politics, or not, across the Thanksgiving table this year. But first, to Kyrgyzstan. Yeah, I know, weird detour before dinner, but stick with me here. It turns out lawmakers in the Central Asian nation were recently debating an amendment to the country's constitution, an important and controversial amendment, one that would have shifted the balance of power between the offices of prime minister and president. But in the course of the debate, one lawmaker piped up with a question. Did anyone know where the original signed version of the Kyrgyz constitution was being kept? How, he asked, could it be amended if it couldn't even be found? Venera Koichev of the BBC Kyrgyz service was one of those closely following the chase.
The minister said, we think it has to be with the presidential administration. Presidential administration says, no, it has to be with the justice minister. And so everybody knew that the lovely, red-colored, beautiful, very important book is lost somewhere.
Kyrgyzstan's political future appeared to hang in the balance. Ordinary citizens began to pitch in with suggestions on social media. Could it be behind the cupboard or behind a presidential bookshelf? One Russian satirist suggested that he had never thought of losing the constitution. It could become a far less troublesome alternative for other despots in the former Soviet Union. After all, why be accused of trampling on the constitution, said the satirist, when it's so much easier to just say it's lost. Eventually, the Kyrgyz presidential office came up with a new explanation that solved everything. The original copy of the Constitution was not lost because it had never existed in the first place. Constitution? What Constitution? You can't lose what you've never had, right? Through it all, though, the country's president, Almazbek Atambayev, never lost his voice. You see, he's also a singer-songwriter, and he's got a hit called In Spite of Fate. Any similarity to Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive is, we're assured, purely coincidental. Питаю звезды глаз твоих, и сквозь года, як маякам, твоих печальных глаз плыву. Пусть не увижу берег я, пусть в серых буднях утону, но я плыву и буду плыть, пока мне руки не свело, но я живу и буду жить. Судьбе назло, и пусть не я, а кто другой надел на палец твой кольцо, и пусть не вызовет в тебе чувств никаких мое лицо. We end things on today's show with you. Last week, we asked how you're handling the potentially volatile politics at the Thanksgiving dinner table this year. We gave you a hotline number to call and leave a message with your stories of hope or horror. Rupa Shenoy of our Otherhood podcast went through all the responses you sent in, right, Rupa?
Yep, and it really took some time. There were lots of them. It was a really interesting cross-section of America and people talking about how they're experiencing this divide that the election exposed inside their own family. And a few people called in to point out that they could argue peacefully within their families.
Yeah, so what else stood out for you?
Lots of people say that they're not going to talk about politics. Some have formal rules against it. They've even planned punishments for talking about politics.
Oh my.
Others are getting ready. They say they refuse to be baited.
Hi, my name is Rachel Clayman. I have three children, 12, 9, and 6. And we are going to my parents' home, who feel very different than we do. And it's going to be very difficult, to the point where I have tried to figure out how I can cancel it nicely, but that has not happened. And the best way that I have found is to just not bring up the topic.
Hi, I'm Tony calling from Los Angeles. And I actually did vote for Donald Trump. My family, very surprisingly, were all Trump supporters. But there is one person I don't want to identify who is a Hillary supporter. And we cannot speak about politics at all because this person says, I will leave. I will not allow you to say those things. They're racist. They're this. They're that. And if you have the views you have, you cannot have a conversation with me.
Yeah, there's some tension there. There's always just put a sign on the door. This is the no politics zone. I'm just wondering, though, Rupa, were there people who kind of want to use Thanksgiving as an opportunity to talk to people across the divide?
A few people. Mm. They were experiencing a lot of trepidation about it, but they did want to do that. This is Jade Flores, who was born in Mexico and is now a 35-year-old mother of two. She has a longtime partner. He's from a conservative family, and she's kind of trying to psych herself up to say something to them.
I may have a platform here. I may be able to get some empathy from them and show them a side that I don't think they've ever seen. I mean, they don't know about my cousin, who I was very close to, that was deported. They don't know about my aunt that had to leave after that because he was her main source of income. Or about my cousin and her husband and her two kids, who were so close to my oldest daughter. They had left because they're scared to live in fear of deportation. If I do bring it up, I'm going to bring it up in a more personal way and maybe possibly see a little bit of what I see.
Yeah, these are not easy conversations and still so fresh right after the election. Were there many people who just were not going to go to Thanksgiving dinner because they didn't want to see family members who voted differently from them?
By far, the most people who called in said that they are avoiding the situation entirely because it would just be too difficult.
Hi, my name is Mark, and I live in Sacramento, California. There is one person in particular who is a very big fan of Donald Trump. I know they're going to go to the holidays and gloat, and it's definitely made me consider not going to any family holidays this year.
Hi, my name is Laura, and I'm calling from San Diego, California. We usually have everyone over to my house, and there's just been so many tears and so much fighting, screaming, and just Thanksgiving for us. I just dreaded so much that as of a couple of days ago, I just announced that it wasn't going to be at my house this year.
Hello, I'm calling from Massachusetts, and just recently found out that I have two brothers and a nephew who are alt-right, which has really made me feel incredibly disturbed, and I am thinking I am just going to be a no-show this holiday season.
Hi, my name is Dory Snow from Redondo Beach, California. My husband's family is Caucasian, and I am African-American, and our children are considered African-American. After the election, one of his family members posted the message, white power, white supremacy, and when I fought back, then I was attacked, as I should respect their opinion. And so Thanksgiving has been canceled. I really hope that other families of mixed heritage aren't going through this like I am.
People were really raw, really vulnerable.
There's some pain in there.
And it really painted a picture of where the country is right now.
If you listeners want to hear more of these responses, you've collected them in this week's episode of Otherhood, right, Rupa?
Right. It's on iTunes and at PRI.org, and I'd really recommend listening to them if you want a better sense of what people are going through.
Rupa Shenoy of Otherhood, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that is all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.